order. It's March 4th, 12 and a half minutes after noon. Happy to see we have Senator Peterson up at the front. I know you've been very active in this on this legislation. And
happy to be here.
Yeah, we're happy to have you on a bipartisan piece of legislation. And I want to thank Senator Boniff. She got the instructions last week to roll up your sleeves, work this thing out. I understand, I think we're about at the 95-yard line or so, and we're pretty close. So I appreciate the effort you and Senator Peterson have put into this particular legislation. So with that, Senator Boniff, did you have an amendment that you want to put on right away to get the bill?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair, the A3 amendment.
Okay, this gets Senator Carlson to move that amendment to get the bill in the order that you'd like on that motion. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Boniff, Senator Peterson, or whoever.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll begin. As you mentioned, we have been working with the Department of Commerce for a great deal of time, and I do want to acknowledge Senator Peterson because he actually has a similar bill, but we've just been working as a team on this legislation, and so what you see before you is the work of that combined approach. And in your packet, there's a grid that shows the concerns that have been raised by legislators, the concerns that have been raised by the Department of Commerce, and then on the right side of the grid reveals the responses that we have made to accommodate those concerns. And so I'm
That's
also
this document here.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I'm also joined by by Ryan and by Zach, who will be happy to answer any questions, but they also attended all of these meetings with Commerce so that we could come to some sort of agreement. And so I thought really the only thing that we needed to do would be perhaps to take you through what the delete all amendment changes were, given we went through the bill last time.
Oh, that's fine. That's
okay.
A good way to approach it, yes.
Thank you. And also, members, in your packet is a copy of the Star Tribune editorial that just so coincidentally ran this morning. So that was perfect timing. And that editorial was submitted by Senator Peterson, myself, Representative Loon, and Representative Atkins. So the delete all amendment, first of all, it changes the limits with which an investor can actually try to raise. So previously we had said that they could raise up to $5 million and only two if it was an audited offering. In this delete all, we have the limit $2 million with an audit, $1 million without. That wasn't what we agreed with. Mr. Chair, we would have preferred to keep it at the original amount, as when we talk to small businesses who are having difficulty accessing capital, we know a lot of that, quote, valley of death that occurs is in between that 2 and 5 number, and so we thought the bill would have been much stronger keeping the cap at 5, but we agreed to that with Commerce, and so you'll see that reflected in the draft. Instructs the escrow agent to run a search of all issuer actors against the OFAC list, and that was really a concern and an awareness brought to us by Senator Pratt. Advertising language outlines the specific guidelines for advertising an offering, mirrors language from other states. We strike the automatic inflator in terms of what can be raised. We added in disclosure requirements to accommodate some concerns. We struck language that exempted the issuers acting as portal operators from paying the registration fee, added language to give the department full access to the portal functions, required operators to maintain an issuer information for at least 5 years. We struck the maximum liability language because really the department was concerned it would actually tie their hands in enforcing their regulations, added bad actor disqualifications that would disqualify individuals' entities from engaging in these offerings if, in fact, they fit some kind of a risk profile. we struck the subdivision with regard to insignificant deviations, and then we did add some data privacy confidentiality language. It should be noted that there will be another additional piece added in judiciary of data privacy language that wasn't quite ready for today's hearing, but we did add one of the pieces that was important to make sure that the issuers knew what data to keep private and what data to keep public. So that's what the delete all does. If Representative Peterson wants to add anything before our testifiers say anything.
Senator Peterson. No, I'm good. I'll let us get to the experts here. Thanks.
Just first observation. Did you add some words on that disclaimer? It looks that it has to be in there, and I think that's a boldface type like that where you lay the cards right out
right
on the table. And good, yes. I don't remember the original bill, but Senator Brown, did you have a?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bonhoff, I'm just wondering if this is going to create enough extra work for the Department of Commerce that there's a fiscal note for this?
No. The answer is no.
4.3.
Mr. Chair says no.
Okay.
4.3, Mr. Chair.
You don't want to hear my speech again.
I've heard it. I just wanted to hear from the author.
Mr. Chair, I've never heard the speech.
No.
But, on this committee,
but I'm getting
you
the
impression. Want the short version? Every time we ask the department to do something, they need 2.4 people or 6.9 or 8.5. And I say, you've got 1,200 employees. Do it. You don't need the 4.2. And Senator Goodwin and I are starting to see eye to eye on that. I know we are.
We are.
Oh, you want full employment.
Okay.
Okay. With that, you got your witnesses want to always identify yourself for the record here.
Hi there. Zach Robbins with the law firm of Winthrop & Weinstein. I think that the senators did an excellent job in walking us through the different changes that have been made through the past month. We've certainly enjoyed sitting down with the Department of Commerce over the past 4 weeks. It hasn't necessarily been easy at times. There's been compromise on both sides, which has been challenging. But in the end, I'm quite confident that we're going to have a stronger bill because of the fact that we've been getting together. So we've gone through the different items here. If there's any questions about anything on the chart, please ask us. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Robbins. Sir, did you wish to? They're going pretty good. So
Yeah, thank you. Ryan Schildkraut, shareholder of law firm of Winthrop & Weinstein. Just like to echo the comments that the two senators and Mr. Robbins have made. The meetings with Commerce have been very productive. And Zach and I having, you know, practicing in this area every day and kind of being an expert on what the different crowdfunding bills look like in different states, I think I can confidently say that this proposed bill would be the best interstate crowdfunding bill in the country. We've been able to borrow the best pieces from all the different forms of legislation throughout the country and taken some helpful suggestions from other legislators, the department, and business owners.
Brown, do you want it? Senator Brown.
I do, right. Mr. Chair. I do want to belabor a point. I understand that there is a request in for a fiscal note. I'm just wondering if this would be the appropriate committee to see that fiscal note or for a committee that it moves on to.
Do we have that?
Mr. Chair, I was just informed by my staff there was a request for a fiscal note, so I don't know where that stands.
Would that be for personnel again? Or?
Mr. Chair, it was the first I've heard, so I don't know who requested it. If you could, if your staff perhaps could shed some light on that.
Mr. Chairman, for one thing, the bill provides for filing fees for portal operators. So that's automatic referral to finance at some point to figure out what that raises and so forth. Whether the department thinks it'll cost them something to implement this or not remains to be seen until the fiscal note is done. Oftentimes, this committee doesn't have a fiscal note in front of them when we move on legislation. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. It's not unusual that we don't. Mr. Mueller is the fiscal analyst for Commerce, is probably the one that made the request, and we can certainly get copies of a fiscal note to all members of the committee as soon as it's available.
That's fine with
when
me.
When I mentioned the 1,200 employees, I didn't mean the Commerce Department number. It's, I think they're about 340 or 350, but my point still remains the same.
Mr. Senator Chair.
Platt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to, a couple of quick comments. I appreciate Senator Bonhoff and Senator Peterson, along with advocates making the changes that we've asked for. I just had a conversation with some of the bankers, and one of the changes that I had asked for was that the portal operator collect the information necessary to perform a Know Your Customer check, as outlined in the USA Patriot Act, to make sure that we don't have money laundering, we don't have terror financing. And that we should be screening that against the Office of Foreign Asset Controller OFAC file. As Senator Bonhoff and I talked about just briefly, there needs to be a little bit more tie-in, that the portal operator needs to provide that information to the escrow agent, and that and understanding what the technical timing of that is going to be. And so I've got assurances that we'll have that ready for at its next stop, which I think was judiciary. The one concern I do have, though, is that we're still allowing the issuer to be the portal operator. And to me, it's one of those things where we need a segregation of duties, that the portal operator should be a standalone entity that's working with an issuer versus having an issuer who's offering equity also be the one providing the portal and the capability to collect those funds and distribute them, and also in effect policing themselves on the Know Your Customer provisions. And so that's still a concern that I have, Senator Bonhoff, and I maybe we can discuss that as well offline.
Mr. Chair, members, that was a great point of discussion in every meeting, and so the bill before you, with all of the protections within it, was in response to that being one of the concerns. And I'll let the testifiers, or Senator Peterson, if he wants to expound, talk about why we did come to the conclusion that, in fact, we did want to allow the issuers to continue being able to offer to be the portal, because it's actually the essence of what the whole things about, but they will speak to that. With regard to the other thing, I do want to make sure everybody understands on line 3.16 through 3.19, we do talk about making sure to run the list against the OFAC list, and the issuer does have to report that. But what Senator Pratt has pointed out is there needs to be an added sentence about the timing of when this report happens, and so we will make sure to include that before we get to judiciary.
Comfortable with that?
I am, Mr. Chair.
Normally, we like to fix a bill up the best we can in this committee, but any response from the witnesses?
Yeah, I'd be happy to respond to that. A couple points on the issue of the issuer running his own portal. And so to kind of bring everyone up to speed on the lingo, the issuer is the company who's trying to raise money, and the portal is the website that investors can go to invest. So there's two ways that you could do this under this legislation. You could either hire a third-party portal. It would be something like a Kickstarter. I mean, it wouldn't be Kickstarter itself, but there would be a third-party website where there would be a lot of deal activity and different investment opportunities for people to look at. Or if someone didn't want to have to pay the fees of a third party, or God forbid third parties didn't emerge who wanted to provide these kind of platforms, we also wanted the issuers to be able to do it themselves. So first of all, it's not that an issuer can just go out and do this and start raising money. The issuer and its portal first has to be approved by the department. So we think that's probably the first protection right there. If the department doesn't think the issuer portal is up to snuff, it won't get approved. Second, I would keep in mind that we need to keep in mind what the current laws say. And right now, any company could go and register their securities with the department, and they could still put them on a website and sell them. So what we're trying to do here is it's an extension of what's already legal. And my third point would be is that we've in our conversations with Commerce, there's been a lot of concerns about investor protection, and it's my view that allowing the companies to interact directly with the investors actually promotes investor protection because you have a direct dialogue between the company and the investors, and that fosters a better long-term relationship between the company and its investors rather than having occur on a third-party platform that's just going to do the deal and go away.
Just, Mr. Chair, just one more point. And we also amended the department's access to the administrator side of the portal. And you can see that in the spreadsheet. That was one of the responses to the Department of Commerce, was allowing them read-only access to the admin side of the portal as well.
All right, Senator Pratt, I think with that understanding, we'll probably be moving it out. But Senator... Or Commissioner Rothman, did you have a?
Mr. Chair, I just want to correct the record. Also, the bill is going to move next to state and local because they had more opening in their calendar, and then go to judiciary. So we'll make the correction that Senator Pratt asked for at its next stop.
Mr. Chair,
at the end of the day, we'd like this bill to look about 98% of what we're doing here today.
Right.
So keep that in mind that this is a committee that really is, I believe, the most jurisdiction over this product. And Commissioner Rothman?
Oh, and Mr. Chair.
Before that, Senator Fischbeck?
Just real quick, Mr. Stang indicated that it was going to go to finance, too. So it'll, you said state and local, judiciary, and finance.
Okay, so we've got three stops.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Commissioner, please come forward. Again, thank you for working with the authors and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, want to thank you and the committee members and thank my good friends, Senator Bonhoff and Senator Peterson, for their work, openness, and collaboration with the Department of Commerce, as well as the stakeholders who bright, smart individuals who worked with our folks at the department on very complex matters. And as you know, and as Senator Bonhoff indicated, that there were a number of investor protection additions to the bill, which we think strengthen the bill. Overall, the Department of Commerce supports the principle of crowdfunding in terms of providing opportunities for small business capital formation by raising money from individual investors. We do work every day with the securities industry, as you know, to ensure that opportunities for capital formation do occur in Minnesota and that they comply with Minnesota law. And in particular, helping small businesses in the capital formation opportunities. I do want to have a couple of points and a few notes. I know that, as you had indicated, we've gotten to about 95-yard line. There's one provision in the bill that the department, I in particular, have reservations about, and that's the individual investor limit. As you know, the department plays a key role in the in financial consumer matters. Our job is to advocate on behalf of the and protect the investors, especially those who lack the expertise and experience or resources like those of accredited investors. We do.
Rothman, is that the $10,000 limit?
That's
so just so the committee knows that that's your concern.
Specifically, yes, that's a concern. We believe that the limit should be lower. It's too high at this moment, it's in essence a it comes out of a concern for the lower or fixed income individuals and whether or not they're being defrauded or would have too much of their income at risk. I also want to thank Senator Bonhoff, and I appreciate the agreement that we have reached to reduce the upper limit of the amount of the company issuers can raise from the $2 million, $5 million down to the $1 million and $2 million, as it's been amended today. It aligns with the department's request and as well as many of the other protections. I do want to say to the committee, it did come up with respect to the question from Senator Brown. There was a request for a fiscal note, and just for background on that, the department is after getting the request, working on it. There are, I would just say a couple things to note. I think it is the filing fees that triggered, that would have triggered it. The second thing is that there is rulemaking in the bill, and so there would be expense for that, potentially in that. And that there is an expertise that we, the department does not have but would need to have, which is the computer background to be able to analyze and look at these portals. So we'll come up with that, and but I don't believe it's an obstacle at all to overall for the bill. And I do want to acknowledge and thank you, Mr. Chair, for recognizing the fact that our 340 people do sometimes seem like we're doing the work of 1,200 people. At the end of the day, I'm very comfortable with the bill proceeding, and we will continue to have discussions with the folks, the stakeholders, and thank you, and happy to answer any questions.
Senator Brown, did you have a question?
I do, Mr. Chair, and I wanted to go back to an issue that Senator Pratt had raised regarding the Patriot Act and the Office of Foreign Assets Control. I believe you said you were going to add some more language regarding that, Senator?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, the language regarding that is in there. What we were going to add is the timing of how it gets shared. We added the language that Senator Pratt
right.
had asked.
My concern, Senator Bonoff, Mr. Chair, is it says that the searches must be done, but it doesn't give any direction on what happens once the searches have been done. Is that all addressed in the Patriot Act and some of these other areas? I'm just concerned that, yeah, they can go ahead and do the searches, but what do we do with it once the searches have been done?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Brown. The searches would need to be conducted by the escrow agents, and if a name were to pop up on the OFAC list, the escrow agent would not provide the escrow. They would be forbidden in upon doing so.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Platt.
Just a point of clarification for Senator Brown as well. Senator Brown, this is something that banks do routinely against their customer files. They have to research them and in fact, try to clear. So, for example, if Fidel Castro were one of the principals in an entity, we would have to confirm that it wasn't the Fidel Castro that whose U.S. assets are frozen. And so there is an investigative process to go through that and hopefully clear and still provide services, and those are done on a very timely basis.
Thank you.
I guess I, for one, am not quite that concerned about the $10,000 threshold. I mean, you've got a page, bottom of page 5 and the top of page 6. All the disclosure. I mean, if you've got $10,000, I would think you should be able to read, number one. And so I'm not that concerned about that threshold. So that's just one person's opinion. But I think you got clearly bold-faced type there that look at it, read it. If you're nervous, don't do anything. You know, don't do it. But anyway, that's my opinion. But okay, what any further discussion on this file? Somebody like to move Senator Bonoff's?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Reinhart would move Senate File 138. He recommended to pass as amended and state and local first. Okay, anybody in the audience? Anybody else want to be heard on this bill? Seeing none, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you for your work,
Thank you.
Mr. Peterson and Senator Bonoff and Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
You're welcome. Okay, we've got Senate File 782 and Senate File 957, both Senator Jensen's bills. They came out of the subcommittee, I believe, last week. And if you'd like to start with the Fraud Prevention Regulation Modification Bill, Senator Jensen, 782.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Jensen.
782 was heard in the Insurance Reform Subcommittee and re-referred to the Commerce Committee. I want to make it really clear. This bill is a consumer protection bill. It protects consumers from people that choose, for various reasons, to act in a deceitful way and present fraudulent behavior. So we've always talked about it being anti-fraud, but I really want to make clear and talk about this and have a conversation about what does it mean for the consumer and what are we really getting at with this bill. There are, as an insurance agent, I took a continuing education class on fraud, insurance fraud. What is it? What does it look like? And it was an eight-hour class. For 8 hours, I learned who is it that is doing this. And there are three types. There are three types. The main two are, of course, professional fraudsters that make a living, their salary, and make their entire living on doing these behaviors where they're able to work the system, figure out how to get money that they shouldn't be getting. And the consequence of that is that insurance companies have to try to figure out and investigate almost all claims because of how prevalent some of this is. The other situation is opportunistic, and that one is even more prevalent, but very difficult to detect, very difficult to prosecute, but exists. And so what we're trying to do is provide the kind of tools that the Department of Commerce needs to actually get some of these convictions. But because they're so difficult to investigate and they are so difficult to prosecute, we've added a civil penalty for the department upon a preponderance of the evidence, the ability to impose a civil penalty for people that are behaving in this way. That's a major portion of this bill. I've done a lot of work on this through the working group last year, the Insurance Fraud Working Group. And basically what it comes down to, as far as whether or not we're going to get legislation passed on this, and all three measures. So the first one in this bill is accident solicitation. We have accident reports that are considered public information and available to anybody that wants to get it. What happens is you are contacted, if you happen to be in an accident, by people that have legitimate reasons to contact you and by people who know they can work the system and gain money by lying and misrepresenting what they're doing. We want to address that. I have an amendment in a minute that I want to add to the bill. The second one is the civil penalties. Let's allow the Department of Commerce to try to deter some of this behavior. And that's what that's meant to do. And finally, the last section of the bill talks about if you are convicted of a fraudulent crime, insurance fraud, you no longer have the ability to participate in the no-fault system. Those are the three things. So at this point, I would like to introduce one amendment that came out of conversation that we had in the insurance reform area.
Wasn't it downstairs?
Let's see. Which one first?
So we might.
Big procedure.
No,
I don't have the amendments.
What are we waiting for, the engrossment?
Yeah, the committee engrossment.
I think we're waiting for the committee engrossment before we can amend the bill now. So,
do I have to wait?
Have to wait. I don't know if there's people like to visit with about the bill so far or what you've done. I'd be remiss if I didn't say thank you to the fraud committee that works hard with you and Senator Kosaka as co-chairs of that informational fraud committee group. And give you a lot of credit for your efforts. Senator Kosaka, did you?
Yeah, I'm thinking since we're waiting, I want to bring the committee's attention to the, in your packet, this report, the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud, because this is not, I mean, there's a number of insurance companies that want to do this, but I want to remind the members that this is about dealing with fraud and how many consumer advocacy groups support this bill. You have the American Council of Consumer Interests, the Center for Consumer Affairs, the Citizen Advocacy Center, Consumer Action, Consumer Alliance, Consumer Federation of America, Consumer Federation of the Southwest. You have the National Association of Consumer Agency Administration. You have the NAIC, that's the insurance commissioners, not companies, but commissioners. National Consumer League, National Criminal Justice Association, National District of Attorneys Association, National Fraud Information Center, National Insurance Crime Bureau, National Urban League, and then a bunch of insurance companies. And so I want people to realize that this is some things that we researched for a couple of years trying to figure out what are the things we can do. And we adopted some of them last year, but these are some of the things that actually had some teeth in turning the tide on this. And this is dealing with the personal injury protection coverage on your automobile policy in Minnesota. And that coverage started when this came out, rolled out in the United States. 25 states had this, but it was so hard to wrangle that now only nine states have it. Even though I think it's a good benefit, and there are reasons, and I support it, I want it, keep it in Minnesota. As some of the fraud began to grow in this, we found that states just said, we're done with it. And keep in mind that these reimbursement rates, what we give to the consumer, are the highest health insurance reimbursement rates out there. It's higher than any work comp insurance reimbursement. It's higher than any of the major medical providers. It's much, much higher reimbursement rates. And so we have to pay particularly close attention to this. So I don't know that the bill is perfect yet, but it is hitting the nail pretty close to the head about some of the things that we can do to really, really make a difference.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'll go ahead.
Senator Brown.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Jensen, I just wanted, reading through this report that Senator Gazelka just mentioned, it talks about Minnesota's being targeted by out-of-state organized crime rings. In your subcommittee, did they report how prevalent that is? Is there a dollar figure attached to just how bad that problem is?
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, we've had testimony not only in the working group but in the insurance reform subcommittee hearing. We heard about a percentage, and my testifiers have some of that information. But what I can tell you is the information that I'm looking at in particular is in Minnesota. And from 2008 to 2012, if you look at just the fraud referrals that were made, in 2008 there were 924. And in 2012, there were 1,424 referrals. Now, how that's divided out, there is some specific information on that report, which I can get to you, too. But the largest increase was in auto. Okay. We know that, which is about a 65% increase.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I think I see a testifier who kind of acknowledged he may, when he comes up, he will address that. So
I think we're going to, a good point, I think we're going to get to the testifiers now and maybe get some of those answers.
Well, Mr. Chair, I also want to make sure that the members understand, throughout this whole process, there are specific groups, and we'll hear testimony and testifying today again about how one group or the other is doing this or doing that. Please keep in mind during the entire testimony that this is about consumer protection, because we all are paying for this fraudulent activity in our premiums because of how the insurance industry has to self-monitor what they do. If we say the insurance company should be paying for this, they don't pay for that. They don't reduce other things. They charge us in premium to take care of that. So we pay for it no matter who's at fault as far as fraudulent activity. So please keep that in mind as you listen to the testimony and stick to some of the numbers and hear some of the numbers that are happening in Minnesota. Other states are tightening down, and these people that have this kind of behavior are smart, and they know where to go, and they know how to work the system, and they are coming here because we're not. So we need to do this. So with that, who's next?
Okay, welcome to the committee. And Johnson, did you want to come up also with as a team? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Jensen. My name is Tim Lynch. Good afternoon. I'm the Director of Government Affairs at the National Insurance Crime Bureau. We're based in Chicago. I've been here a few times now, so it's starting to feel like home. So thanks for having me.
Why don't you move here?
When I left Chicago, it was 6, and I came here, it was 2 degrees. So,
all right.
Quickly about the NICB, we are a national not-for-profit organization that works with our member companies and in close conjunction with law enforcement to identify, investigate, and deter insurance fraud. But namely, we focus on organized crime. We are active not only here in Minnesota, but in every state across the country. In short, we are in strong support of this piece of legislation. The enactment of these remedies, along with the good work from those here in the room from law enforcement, can make Minnesota a most inhospitable state for those seeking to commit insurance fraud, and most importantly, improve your anti-fraud environment to protect consumers. NICB has been fighting insurance fraud for 101 years. The fact that we're still at it says something about the serious nature of this crime, even as we get better and better at detecting it and passing laws to deter it.
Okay, great.
And that brings me to the point that Senator Jensen was making. The fact of the matter is, some of the successes in other states, and what I mean by successes is anti-fraud legislative crackdowns in states such as Florida and New York and others, have led organized criminal rings to migrate here because of a perceived and, in fact, real, less aggressive fraud environment. And in terms of your question, Senator Brown, on some statistics, NICB is the questionable claim repository for our member companies. And obviously, our friends from the Commerce Department also see those fraud referrals. And in several different areas of questionable claim activity, whether it's a rise in medical fraud questionable claims, Minnesota ranks very high nationally. Most of those top 5 and top 10 lists, which you don't want to be on, you're on. And that's unfortunate. What you lead in two categories is two things that are problematic. Number one is that migration organized criminal rings to this state. You rank very high in that category. I can't give you a dollar amount, but what I can tell you is as the numbers are increasing and increasing quickly. Number two is there's a specific thing we measure called organized criminal activity. That's organized crime. These folks do not discriminate. They rip off anyone, and they're smart, and they look for loopholes. And unfortunately, your state has been looked on as one of those states to where there's the moving in. So those are two distinct categories which you lead. And again, I don't say that in a congratulatory fashion. We want to change that. And for the crooks, insurance fraud is low risk for a high reward. And unfortunately, statistics show that this crime costs Minnesotans $1,400 a year. Now, what do these schemes look like? Many of these things are staged automobile accidents with people working in collusion. Those are shady medical providers, lawyers, all hired to funnel unsuspecting claimants. And we are seeing some problematic activity here with some victimization of elderly citizens and immigrant populations. I think Tony Palumbo, the attorney from Anoka County, said it best. Insurance fraud is bad people doing bad things to good people. The provisions of the bill, I won't belabor them. They, Senator Jensen spoke to them, but they are the civil penalty provision. This is enacted in several other states, including Maryland. And this, in essence, allows the Commerce Department to get it into the pocketbook of these organized criminal rings. Obviously, if the process, law process goes forth, we're looking, obviously, for we like the criminal conviction, but the civil conviction would be a bonus because these folks have ripped off your state for too long. And this would be a tool to allow the Commerce Department to get after them. Two, we're looking for a modest 30-day cooling-off period for accident reports. I know we're working through some language challenges on that. I'm confident we'll get there. But again, these provisions have been enacted in several other states, including Michigan, Texas, Florida, and others. A third, a deauthorization provision that would, in short, if a health provider has been found guilty of committing fraud, this would prevent them from receiving payment in the future, not affect their ability to practice law, to practice medicine, excuse me. So in short, we support this bill. I want to take a moment to bring up two items that came up in the subcommittee in terms of some folks that testified on the bill. Number one, when I mentioned these other states, none of these other states have succeeded in defeating fraud by virtue of these laws being passed. New York had 9,000 questionable claims last year. Your state has about 2,000. New York has hardly are putting up a victory sign saying we've defeated fraud because of these bills. They've seen a very modest reduction in fraud. I want to make that clear. No states are declaring victory because of passage of these laws. But what they have seen is a modest reduction. I want to make that point clear. Secondly, and this was made part of the record by Bob Johnson last week, there was a recent study put out, I know it's part of the record, referencing a fraud buildup in certain states where Minnesota ranks fourth with a 22% buildup on fraud claims. There was a reference made that this is possibly insurance companies disputing insurance claims in the wake of serious storms and in the wake of natural disasters such as tornadoes. This study measures medical auto injury claims. It has nothing to do with property losses whatsoever. So I just want to make that clear for the record since that came up last week. But I just want to, again, conclude with saying NICB strongly supports this bill. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
The questions of Mr. Lynch at this point. Senator Goodwin, did you have a question?
Yeah. I want to clarify. Did you say that fraud in Minnesota cost each Minnesotan $1,400 a year? Was that your statement?
That was my statement. It's not our statistic. It came from, I believe, a Minnesota State Department.
$1,400.
That would be accurate with most national studies come across that same number.
And do you know what that is based on? How is that figured, that number?
Mr. Johnson, do you have an answer?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin, it is an estimate that's put together collaboratively between the industry, these statistical information gatherers like some of the materials you have there, working with Commerce Commissioners, the fraud unit here has put that number. This actually can go back to former Minnesota Attorney General Skip Humphrey would put in his materials that the cost impact to the average Minnesota family or consumer. At that time, Attorney General Humphrey used the $1,000 figure. Now, that's premiums and the cost of goods and services, so it's that broader measure. Senator, it's clearly an estimate. There's not a concrete database that documents that, but I would tell you the collaborative effort of public and private groups, prosecutors, law enforcement, Commerce Department, regulators, the industry, the statistical gathering entities believes that about 10% of all claims are fraudulent. That's really how that number then is constituted, pegging off of that 10% number.
So,
Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Chair,
So I'm going to ask you once again, my friend, Mr. Johnson, if this bill passes, this is a very tough fraud provisions in this bill. How much do you expect that the insurance industry will be able to reduce rates?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin, I'll say two things on it. And the first one is that, and this is one of the comments I was going to make in my testimony, and I did at the subcommittee, was a recent report coming out of Florida and a study of claims by the Florida Commerce Department as to what happened under their 2012 insurance no-fault fraud reform. So they actually measured, has it impacted consumers? I'm saying all that to say that there is a time lag between passage, implementation, and to see if it impacts the way you intended it, because we don't always hit the mark when we pass laws. But the Florida Department measured the impact of their 2012 reforms. And they're different. I'm not going to go through the details because they had other items that are not in this bill. And they quantified a 43% reduction in personal injury protection rates in the 2 years after. Now, that's one piece of the multiple pieces of premium. So it didn't necessarily translate to an overall premium reduction. But I would say this, that's significant. It's actually quantified, and I think if you checked with the Florida regulators, they would tell you consumers are seeing the benefit, specifically on this bill and the provisions as we're working through it. I can't tell you, Senator Goodwin, that it's going to translate to, because you know we're putting together the pieces. Is it going to stick together? Is it actually going to impact the solicitation issue? Is it actually going to impact the use of the civil fining authority? I think the department is listed as a witness here today, and I'm pretty certain that they have contacted their Maryland counterparts, that what Senator Jensen has in her bill is in part looking at what Maryland did to combat no-fault fraud in that state. So I'm not being evasive. I'm being as specific as I can, but I am assuring you and testifying that here is concrete evidence of a state legislature's effort to combat no-fault fraud, producing benefits to the consumers of that state in terms of their premiums and the costs.
Well, Mr. Chair, one final.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I find it interesting that we always have the statistics of how we're going to help the insurance industry and what's costing the insurance industry right now, but we never have the cost of what we're going to save for the consumer. And I just found out from independent insurance agents in my district that they cannot even get the reason why the insurance rates of one of their consumers have gone up, because it's just such a complicated, this is what they're told, it's just such a complicated stuff that's put into any increases in rates, so that even an independent agent is frustrated because they call the company. One guy's rates went up $200 a month. He had a perfect credit score, never had any problems. Suddenly, rates went up $200 a month. The insurance company had claimed they could not break that down in any way because of the complicated way that they process their rates. So, and actuaries, I know, are some of the most specialized people in any occupation, and it's a very very difficult job, but that's their job, is to figure that out and try to make sure that the rates are what you need and so forth. But yet, a consumer cannot even find out why their rates go up. So it just, I like when I'm surprised when all these numbers are thrown out here that we're going to be able to do. But you can't throw out numbers as to why a person's rates go up or anything.
Senator
like
Kosaka, did you have a
question? Yeah, if I can comment to Senator Goodwin, because I'm in the industry and I'm probably work for that, sell for that company you're talking about. A number of companies, it's become far more sophisticated, all the variables that they use to figure out a rate, and so each individual rate is hard to predict. That is true. That's very hard to predict. But you can see what's happening on a statewide basis, or probably even more local than that, where a company will say rates are going up 5% or they're going down 5%, whatever the number is. But then how that spreads out to all the individual ones, that's where you know, the individual agent can't track it anymore. You know, but some of these things that we're trying to do, I think at the very minimum, they will bend the curve of how fast personal injury protection costs have gone up. They have gone up a lot, where when we first started writing this back before I was here, the amount of the personal injury protection that went towards a soft tissue claim, a chiropractor, a physical therapist, et cetera, was a smaller percentage. That's suddenly become a very large percentage of personal injury protection. So all the other things that we want to use it for, emergency medical care, et cetera, compete for that in a different way. And so it is me being an agent, I cannot tell an individual person's rate. But I do get to see what happens on a statewide basis, you know, whether rates are going up or down.
But, Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka, that doesn't help a consumer one bit. And if it's that complicated, then something has to be changed so that a consumer can be told and know why their individual rates are going up. It is plain. It is. It's otherwise, it's like highway robbery. You're just going to say, this is happening to everybody in the state, but yours in particular went up a lot. But we can't tell you why.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, I can tell you some of the reasons. Certainly their credit, are they making their payments on time? Do they have any tickets? Do they have any claims? How many claims? What kind of claims? Those are all factors, but there's far more factors today than there used to be. That's where there used to be one rate for a group of people. Now that's been segmented into many different rates. And when that first started hitting the industry, I thought, well, how can they use a predictive model that can actually segment it much more? But then, you know, they showed us the loss ratios, and it's very scientific. I mean, they use it in every industry now, matrices, and how they do what they do is amazing, and it's frustrating for the consumer, you know. But they're in it to make a profit, and those that are basically more risky than others end up paying a little more than others.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Jensen, did you want to
take
a shot at that?
I do. Just Senator Goodwin, as an insurance agent also, I am faced with trying to deal with the individual. But what we're trying to do with this particular bill is address the issue of the amount of cost the industry has to put into trying to investigate and find fraudulent behavior, and the fraudulent behavior, the amount of money that's put out that shouldn't be. So what that does is, like I said, the insurance companies are not going to reduce other things and absorb that. They put it on your premium because they have to stay operating, just like a retail store when they have problems with shoplifters and they have to add more staff or add more cameras or some kind of security. That costs them to do their business. They add that to the price of the materials that you're buying. And so this is a domino effect, but the consumer pays every time more money to try to deal with that particular thing. So what we're doing in here is providing some assistance, the availability of the state to participate in that process so that we can reduce the cost and reduce the fraudulent behavior that's happening so we don't have to add more. Because as this rises 65% in 4 years, it's going to continue to rise unless we address it and figure out how to stop it. So I understand your concern on individual, but this is about, in total, how much are our premiums going up because of fraudulent behavior, and that the consumer is going to be impacted because we pay for it now. And if it doesn't go up, we're not going to have to pay those rates. But we're also going to take some people that are doing things they shouldn't be and getting them to stop, which impacts the consumer directly. So that's what we're trying to do with these particular provisions, is try to deter some of the behavior that takes place. Now, as far as actual rates, the rates do have to be filed and approved by the Department of Commerce when an insurance company puts out their rates. That process takes place, and there is someone else that does regulate and has to look at what the rates are, too. So that's what I'd say about that.
Okay, continue on. Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a brief question. I had a bill up, so I was in another committee. So if you've answered this already, then I'll ask one of my colleagues. But my question is, is what's the significance of the civil penalty being instituted when, if a person is guilty of fraud and they go through the criminal proceeding, there's restitution. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to understand, is it one or the other, both, and if so, what, why?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Jensen.
Senator Champion, through the working group, what we learned is that these cases are extremely hard to investigate and to bring to resolution, and there's not a lot of prosecutors that are taking up the cases. So there is a need and a direct need to make sure that if there is preponderance of the evidence that we can do the civil penalty to deter people from participating in the process to begin with.
So, Mr. Chair, just one follow-up. Is my understanding when you think in terms of filing a civil petition, mm-hmm. You have a burden to prove that there's lost and loss and so on and so forth. So are you suggesting that the restitution process that's already criminally involved is not adequate in order for the insurance industry to articulate to an objective body that they have these losses and that these losses is caused by the person who is the defendant, and therefore the defendant should be responsible for those losses? So is that what you're suggesting?
Mr. Chair.
We need a reaction to what?
Senator Jensen, I think we can respond. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Champion, I think as Senator Jensen has just indicated, we're looking for in the toolbox to fight the fraud, what are tools that in addition to the criminal will add some strength behind and deterrence to the behavior. So this added civil penalty, I think Commissioner Rothman has in fact got other legislation introduced this year in the area of vulnerable adults calling for enhanced civil penalties. And there may be behavior in that area that could be criminal, but it's behavior that we're looking to frankly put an impediment or a discouragement from that those activities. So it's we have civil penalties. I think it's in addition to the tools and what's in place today that we're looking to enhance that. And again, the state of Maryland has done that recently. I know the department is on the witness list here for today, and they probably even had some conversations with the Maryland regulator counterparts about how is that enhanced civil penalty working in the state of Maryland to deal with these exact kinds of problems that we're talking about.
Okay.
Should Mr. Chairman, can I continue and I'll just quickly wrap up?
Yeah, quickly wrap up.
I'll be quick. Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota, I'll just focus on a couple of areas that perhaps I haven't covered so far. Members, you do have in your packet a letter from Ramsey County Attorney John Choi. I guess I just wanted to flag it. Mr. Choi couldn't be here. And so I know our Ramsey County Attorney is in support of Senate File 782, and this letter speaks for itself. Mr. Chairman, just a couple of quick things. As has been testified from our perspective, this problem of insurance fraud, it's real, significant, and it's growing in this state. The focus of this, I think, unfortunately, sometimes a hearing like this seems to be kind of pitting us, if it's the insurance industry, against a Main Street provider that are in your communities or even an attorney practicing there. And hopefully what this message we're giving here is that this is a focused effort to deal with, and what law enforcement and prosecutors and the regulators in our industry is seeing is staged auto accidents, focused criminal activity in the state. I heard at a meeting at the Commerce Department a year and a half ago or so, former Minnesota U.S. Attorney Mr. Jones speaking to a group, talking for a couple-hour meetings, talking about the international financial gangs that are operating in Minnesota for purposes of taking advantage of and advancing in insurance fraud schemes. So, really, members, this is not pitted debate and a battle. between the industry and, again, Main Street providers and attorneys that are in all of your communities. We genuinely are trying to focus on that. I commented at the subcommittee on a letter, because I think sometimes people say, well, that's a problem elsewhere, and you haven't made the case that it's a real issue in Minnesota and it's a significant issue. And I read off of a letter, and it's in an administrative law judge public record, of an attorney talking about his working on, over the last 3 years, a staged auto accident ring in Minnesota, which he just received a whole series of sworn statement confessions from the participants involving 300 to 500 staged auto accidents, 4,000 no-fault claims, and benefits in excess of $50 million. And just to repeat that for the full committee here, Mr. Chairman, this is the real deal. Those $50 million get loaded into the premiums of the companies charging all of us and your constituents dollars. And if we can't find out a way to stop that and get in the way of that, then that $50 million and then the next $50 million, it's significant. And I think that's where you see some of the numbers adding up. So it's real. It's here. It's growing. Secondly, states are acting. The accident solicitation, the attempt to get at that. There's a list of states that have acted. Texas acted on a law like this a few years back. Their data cut back on some of the fraud claims, and then they found it ticked up in Arkansas. And this is truly whack-a-mole stuff. Whack it down in New York, and we have statistical evidence that there's a migration of the fraudsters to Minnesota or Michigan or Kentucky. So what do all those states have in common? They have no-fault auto systems. They have no-fault auto systems, and sadly, and I've had this conversation even this year with former senator and judge Jack Davies, who is the chief author of Minnesota's no-fault law, and he was my first law school professor. We've talked about the no-fault law and kind of the mission and the purpose, but if the system has weaknesses, the bad people exploit the weaknesses, and that's actually what's happening here. So states are acting. And then lastly, Mr. Chairman, and I should have commented on this in the subcommittee, and I omitted that, but it's directly on some of the comments that will be made about the bill and how insurers handle claims. Those little green books back there, if we pulled up and looked at Minnesota Statute 72A.201, you don't know what that is, but that is called the Minnesota Claim Settlement Practices Act. Very detailed statutory standards on how auto insurers are required in Minnesota state law. And actually that law, some of you that may go back far enough, was spearheaded by former Commerce Commissioner Mike Hatch. So when Mike Hatch was Commerce Commissioner under Governor Perpich, 72A.201 was passed into law. It's detailed standards that mandate how we have to handle auto claims, including we're required to contact the individual who's been in a claim. We're mandated to contact them within 10 days. That's the law. We're required to settle the case within 30 days. Now, if the circumstances, serious injury, somebody's in a hospital, they're ongoing treatment, obviously then that mandate doesn't apply. And that same statute has very specific standards on settlements, kind of the who, what, when, where, why, the documentation, what has to be noted, the communications between auto insurers. So I'm just commenting that we do have extensive laws. They've been on the books for 20-plus years. They're enforced by our regulator. And they govern the conduct of insurers in terms of how claims are filed. So, Mr. Chairman, we support Senate File 782. We think the provisions in it are important tools, not only, you know, for myself, the Insurance Federation, talked to independent agents, the brokers, the 5,000-plus agents that are selling in your communities. They support this bill. They believe that these are reasonable provisions, and we urge your passage. Thank you.
Okay, procedurally, let me do it this way. I think we have to adopt the subcommittee report, so let's do that first of all. Senator Jets moves that. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Then would you wish to counsel there?
Yes.
And I think there's a substitute.
Mr. Chairman, we have also handed out this 782 CE1, which engrosses a subcommittee report into the bill so the committee has something they can work off of and understand in terms of amendments today.
Legal question.
Senator Goodwin.
Just a quick legal question. Maybe our counsel can answer this. Would this bill allow the Department of Commerce to fine somebody up to $25,000 with no court action at all, just allow them to impose a fine?
Senator Goodwin, it's my understanding that that would have to be done in the context of a contested case hearing under Chapter 14, the Administrative Procedure Act in Minnesota. That's not a court hearing. It's an administrative action. I believe ultimately there's appeal from that to the court system at the end of that process. But, you know, I don't consider myself an expert on Chapter 14 by any means, but that's my general understanding of how it works.
Senator Champion on that
issue. Point, yes. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to provide some clarification and what it is a part of my concern. Under Chapter 14, which is an administrative procedure, that means a person can go through that process, but they do not have a right to an attorney or no attorney will be provided. So if it's an indigent person who is going through the process, they have to go it alone or find the money by which to have an attorney. Here's the other thing. An ALJ or an administrative law judge under this process does not make the final decision. They only make a recommendation to the commissioner. And the commissioner is the one who makes a final judgment in that context. So then this person who might be indigent has the commissioner who wants to, whose department it is putting forth this penalty, makes the final judgment. Now I, as the indigent person, can only now appeal to the Court of Appeals. And my concern around that is when we allow that and not allow it to remain in the criminal process, what happens is that in the criminal context, if a person wants to dispute restitution or what has been put forward, they still have counsel with them, and counsel can advise them as to what their rights are, the strengths and weaknesses, and they have a right to a hearing. And so what is being proposed today says the department can, you know, put forward this notion of a civil penalty. It's in the administrative law process. An indigent person doesn't have a right to counsel or have access to counsel because they probably can't afford it. And I just, unfortunately, I think it's a problem. So I just wanted to fill that out so that we understand that process.
What panel up there? Do you have a little more discussion on Senator Champion's remarks? I'm concerned, too, now that he brought up the indigent folks.
That's what happens.
What protection or what say will they?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll just make one comment and others can comment. I mean, I think Senator Champion is that A, the triggering of this is being done by a regulator and the Commissioner of Commerce, who's a consumer advocate who actually fields and deals with every industry if there's complaints. So in other words, so the individual that's initiating the action is going to have, you know, the file and the actions and the facts that, I mean, I view them as a consumer protection agency and the regulator of the practices of our industry, and they enforce the laws. And so for me, part of the, I don't know if it's a response to your concern, but the protections is that we're talking about the agency that we entrust with the protection of Minnesota consumers. And they have authority today, broad authority in terms of investigative authority and looking at all licensed entities, that they're the ones that are putting forth that this is behavior that warrants these added penalties. So I think that's A, it's put in the hands of a state agency who regulates the laws, who regulates the industry, and is making a determination as to whether this penalty is going to help deter the conduct. So it's not directly responsible, but that is the system we have under Chapter 14, and how agencies work, and how the ALJ makes a recommendation to the agency, and then they make a decision based on that recommendation.
Saka, did you want to hear from Commerce Department?
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering if Commerce wants to weigh in at all on that. I see Mr. Brickwitty here, and he may not be ready to answer, but we may have get a sense for how they would handle that.
Yeah, that's a legitimate concern, yes. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, Peter Brickwoody from the Department of Commerce. Senator Champion has laid out, I think, precisely the exact procedure that would be employed. As we read the committee subcommittee engrossment, it would be consistent with the current practice, as Mr. Johnson was indicating, the current practice for the department in all of its administrative capacities.
Mr. Chair, to that point.
Oh, Senator Brown, excuse me.
To Senator Champion's point, Senator Champion, I'm wondering if the point you've raised, is it the same as what would apply to, say, the MPCA? They have a right to issue fines and so forth. Is the standard the same for each commissioner? Wouldn't indigent people be affected by, say, what the MPCA had the authority to do? Is it the same process, do you know?
Champion, you have it up.
Mr. Chair, I don't know specifically there, but I know that under Chapter 14, whenever there's an administrative issue, that what I've laid out is the process. What we have before us is a department saying we want to put forth the civil penalty on top of or instead of whichever route they want to take, instead of the criminal process. And in the criminal process, why that's important here is because usually if there's a victim, they can put forward what their out-of-pocket expenses are, and that becomes a part of a restitution order. If that's put forward, then the defendant is put on notice that here is what they believe the out-of-pocket expenses are. If the defendant disagrees, then there's a hearing before a judge and all the necessary parties come forward. And if I'm indigent, I have an attorney that's sitting next to me that can advise me. Under this context of what's being proposed, is if someone is truly violated the law, and I'm not suggesting that they did or did not, I'm just saying that there's a problem, and we should be thoughtful if someone is accused of committing a crime, and if they have committed a crime, then there's the restitution process, and we will want to protect someone's due process rights and allow them to have counsel available so that they can say yes or no or what. And so that's what I'm saying. But I don't know specifically about that particular agency, but I'm more concerned about the more global notion because I do some work here, so I understand that the ALJ's position or recommendation is just that to the commissioner who makes the final decision. So, I mean, it's not as if that neutral party is going to make a decision and that's going to be the binding decision.
Right. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Champion, I was just curious if this was unique to just the Commerce Department or if it extends to other departments.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Jensen.
All agencies have to comply with 14045. All agencies that currently have the ability to impose a civil penalty have to do the exact same procedure that we're talking about in this particular area. So what Senator Champion is bringing up is that we would have to take a look at 14045 and change it for every agency currently that has been given this authority through, that's what they do. Every agency that has the ability to impose a civil penalty has to comply with the exact same procedures that would have to take place in this. We're just providing it now to the Department of Commerce to be able to do it exactly the same as it would be for every other agency that has it.
Mr. Chair, I think there is a little bit of difference, though, because most of the agencies are trying to either protect Minnesota resources groups of people. But what's happening here is we're trying to protect an industry. So we're
We're trying to protect. I'm sorry, Senator Goodwin.
I don't know if that's a fair characterization. Go ahead, Senator Jensen.
Senator Goodwin. This is protection of consumers. This is a consumer protection bill. If the industry wanted to, they could put a lot more resources into it and charge the consumer. It's the consumer. But the fraudulent activity that it takes place is against the consumer. Anti-fraud takes place against a consumer. So it's just that in this particular instance, we pay a premium and the insurance company pays the loss. So it is protecting consumers. The Department of Commerce is a consumer protection agency, and that's what they regulate, and that's who we're giving the power and the ability to protect the consumer with fraud, insurance fraud ability to penalize. And that's what they do. That's their job.
I think Senator Kosoko mentioned it before, but I got a list here of American Council and Consumer Interests, Consumer Action, Consumer Alliance, Citizens Advisory Center. I know the list goes on, and I don't think these are all big insurance companies. A lot of consumer are listed protection on this list. So,
Mr. Chair, just one quick comment is that we are asking the Department of Commerce. It is not a consumer agency. It is both the prosecutor and the defense, because we ask them to protect the industries and we ask them to protect the consumers, which is really can be a conflict of interest. And I'm not sure one agency should be on both sides of the issue. You know, a lot of states have consumer protection agencies that will protect consumers on a number of issues. We don't have that here. We have a little bit of that with the Attorney General's office. We don't have that here. So we are asking, and every time we pass a bill like this, we're asking them to be the prosecutors. And other times we ask them to be the defense attorney. So I think that, you know, that's just an inherent problem with the way our system is set up. But I'm just saying we can't call it a consumer protection agency because it is not.
And Mr. Chair, yeah, thank you. And I guess my point is from what Senator Jensen said, this extends to all commissions. So this isn't an issue specific to commerce. So if this is an area that needs to be dealt with, it's not going to get dealt with in this committee. But it extends to all. It's not specific to commerce.
Okay. Where are we at? Senator Jensen, did you have any other witnesses? Or do we have to move on?
I have a couple of amendments to address some issues that came up in the insurance reform subcommittee.
We have to adopt, first of all, the CE1 amendment. Okay, we adopted the committee report, which reflects the CE1. Okay. Senator Jensen.
The CE1 amendment.
You could start explaining it while it's being passed out. This is
the
A3
and the
A4. A3?
It's the A3 amendment. That's correct. It deals with Section 1 and changes the definition used for insurance fraud to the section in the civil law area 60A.9151, Subdivision 4, rather than what we had, which described in the definition of insurance fraud in the criminal code.
Not enough information to the committee members to adopt this. I think we're all right on the motion to adopt the A3 by Senator Jensen. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Jensen, will we have the A4?
Yes, A4 amendment. Mr. Chair.
Senator Jensen,
Mr. Chair,
the A4 amendment.
This deals with which section is it? Okay, in Section 1, we are deleting the new language. And the conversation was that we had in the insurance reform was that we really did exclude everyone from having availability. We were making everything in that accident solicitation area private information for 30 days, and that wasn't correct. That's not what we meant to do at all. What we were doing was saying for accident reports that those should be considered private for 30 days and then could be public after that point. So this language removes the 30 days so that that section stays the way that it is currently in statute, but adds an exception for traffic accidents.
I was just a little concerned about people being at the desk here with our people that have the election certificates. I think we should go out in the lobby and talk to a senator at the desk.
Then what it does is it allows some exceptions to that too. So accident reports are pulled out, or they're left in, but they're added as an exception for 30 days. And then we allow radio, television, newspaper, the same language that was in Division 4 is pulled into this area so that it connects together. And that's the conversation that we had in the Insurance Reform Committee, and it was meant to address those concerns, which we knew needed to be cleared up.
Committee, all right with this?
This is better.
Senator Latz on the amendment, the A4.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It looks like you're basically just moving much of the content around within the bill. Is that right?
Well, we moved it because we wanted to leave the section to say all of the other things that are public, that will stay that way, except for traffic report.
So
that would be the only thing that would have the 30-day wait period.
At our lads.
So what is left that would be public immediately then?
Yep. I can tell you.
Everything else that's listed on that particular section.
Subparagraphs A through...
The way that the statute has been is that it would be for... any law enforcement agency which documents agency response to a request for service. So all of that would remain public information other than traffic accidents. That's pulled out. I mean, it stays there, but we add an exception that it remains private and for 30 days.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
So the fact of an accident at a particular time and location involving particular parties with names and addresses and so on.
Correct.
Would remain private for 30 days.
That's correct.
Mr. Chairman,
there's
at some
some
point,
exceptions, I think. But
yeah, there's some
exceptions in there, Senator Jensen. I saw them earlier.
And those are exceptions that were already identified in the underlying
Yeah.
Bill, is that correct? Are any changes there?
No, there are no changes there.
Mr. Chairman, at some point I'd like to engage in a discussion with regard to the overall notion of a 30-day so-called cooling off period. I'm not sure if this is the point at which to
Well, I think it is the point. I mean, this is the hearing on this thing and this bill that people have worked on, and this is the proper place to vet your point. We don't want to move it out of here without ample discussion, and so if we don't get to a consensus today, or at least some kind of an understanding, we just keep going until we do.
Mm-hmm.
If you have that 30-day discussion, we'll keep going.
Well, then I guess let's have that discussion. I mean, my question in part is which consumer is being protected? Because there's one particular consumer that's involved here, in any particular accident, and that's the parties to the accident. Mm-hmm. And there's the consequence, and we had this discussion in past years in this committee as well, but the consequences of a 30-day cooling-off period might well be that those individual consumers will have less information about which to make decisions on how to handle their situation. And I'm speaking specifically what we've talked about before is the advertising that gets mailed out to these individuals. And, of course, that's prohibited or defined out of the newspapers in your amendment as well. So I don't see any protection in here for those consumers, including protection from insurance company, their own insurance company that might seek to rush to settle the claim mm-hmm. before that 30-day period expires. So perhaps, Senator Jensen, you could help me understand that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Latz, this is an issue that has had some conversation, that we've had a lot of conversation about, on how do we handle this, in particular what you're talking about on the insurance side if they do a claim. I think there is an amendment out there that would address that issue if someone's willing to offer that.
I wasn't sure if I could offer the amendment while this one was still on the table.
Oh.
True, too.
You can talk about it.
Okay.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I forgot
to
ask permission.
Go ahead.
So, Senator Latz, I have an amendment once we get through this where the insurance companies would have to inform someone of a right to counsel before reaching a settlement. The idea being exactly what you talked about, that we want to make sure that consumers understand their rights and that they're not forced into a settlement without knowing everything that they're entitled to know.
Senator Latz, did you?
Yes. Part of the devil's in the details, so I guess I'd like to see that amendment at some point, but just a notification by the insurance company as a part of a settlement package of documents. They've already had a conversation with their insured. They've agreed they're going to pay the insured $10,000. Even if theoretically, if they had a counsel, they might have gotten $30,000 or $40,000. But they got this package in front of them. They got a check is waiting to be handed over to them, and they got a bunch of documents that includes three lines, maybe in bold, maybe in not, that says, by the way, you have a right to have an attorney review this before you sign anything. To me, that's not enough protection, but I'd like to see what the
okay.
So I have the amendment now.
Senator Jensen, did you?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, I don't know if we will come to an agreement on how do we weigh out the protection for that group or the protection for people that are getting this and using it to commit fraud. I know they do this in other states. They have found that it has reduced. So, and it is meant to protect the consumer. There have been lots of ideas that have been put out. One of my ideas was maybe we should have it that you have the right to an attorney on the ticket when you get an accident report. Maybe something to think about. I would like to talk to you about that if that's something you're willing to consider. If that's what we're weighing out, mm-hmm. is just making sure that the person that's in the accident has the information and understands their rights to an attorney and those types of things, I think there are ways we can do that while providing a 30-day wait period on this information so that people that are utilizing that to commit fraud have that ability reduced. And I think that's important. I think that's an important thing that we need to do as a state, and other states are doing this. So I think we can figure out how to make that happen, unless we're talking about something else.
I agree. There's been a couple of interesting points brought up here, and I've been very supportive of the work and the effort that's been put into this, but I think that Senator Latz and
Champion and Goodwin probably have a couple of issues here that we might want to look at. So,
I don't want to
rush to judgment on this. And
well, Mr. Chair,
we're going to do something in fraud. Don't get me wrong, and I'm a big supporter of carrying something forward. But
the next stop is judiciary too. I know you want to do the work here. I understand that. I just don't know if we would.
I've been consistent over the years, I think, of saying that what's our jurisdiction, we gotta work on here, and we do the. That doesn't mean that something's not gonna.
So, Mr. Chair, is it the entire package that we're concerned with, or is it a specific portion?
Well, I don't know. I think you could have a little sidebar conversation with Senator Latz and Champion. I'm not sure you're going to get there, but.
Well, if it's Section 1 that's the issue, we can take that out.
We're supposed to be out of the room.
Is that.
Mr. Chair.
I'm not a fan.
Senator Fishback, do you have a.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to say, you know, we're just talking about Section 1 at this point, but we haven't even heard from some of the other testifiers yet.
Yeah, that's true.
So there may be more issues, potentially. So.
All right. Senator Reinhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just add, you know, I like Section 1. I would hate to see it go. I think the Commerce Committee should address that issue. You know, maybe we don't leave committee with a unanimous vote on a portion, but it's coming to judiciary next, and I think judiciary is a great place for them to dig into that period and what that means for people's legal rights and representation and settlements and all that sort of thing.
All right. Do we
have we approved?
There's a couple more witnesses on the list here. You think we should, why don't we hear from them and see what they have to say?
Adopt the amendment?
Oh, the A4 amendment? Can we adopt that, I suppose?
No. Mr. Chairman?
Is that what you're...
I don't know who else is on the witness list, but I suspect some of them may have something to say about the topic we're discussing this moment.
On the four.
I'd rather hear
all
them.
All right, that's a good point.
Or decide.
Okay, let's bring up... I like that. So Joel Carlson or Kevin Goodnew or Wayne Dahl, I don't think we've heard from. Yes, yeah, welcome, Representative.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Goodnow, and I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Chiropractic Association. And I just wanted to focus my comments on Sections 2 and 3 of the bill. First of all, I want to thank Senator Jensen and Senator Gazelka for their work on no-fault fraud. We've worked closely together over the last few years and appreciate the movement that has been made on this bill so far. But I want to highlight some concerns we continue to have with the bill, even as amended. On Section 2, and I think this is important to understand with regard to the administrative penalty that Senator Champion was talking about, is that this adds in, even with the amendment focusing it on civil penalties, it actually changes the scope of it when you apply it to the civil penalty rather than the criminal. Because if you look at the statutory citation, I believe I'm correct on this, under the civil penalties it only applies to people who are defrauding the insurer, whereas 609.611 is more general insurance fraud. So by making that change, you're actually imposing the penalties only on the individuals that are dealing with the insurer, be it the provider or the individual insured. So I think that changes the scope. But the other aspect to keep in mind there is that Commerce has been charged with regulating insurance companies. By adding this provision in with regard to the penalties, they're now being asked to regulate individuals and providers, which they currently do not regulate under this prospect. When we talk about administrative penalties, I know with the Board of Chiropractic Adjusters, they currently have the ability to levy fines against their licensees. I know at the Department of Human Services, the commissioner has the ability to levy fines against licensees there, but typically it's not random individuals who are not licensed by the organization. Now, that may change from organization to organization, but I know in those two cases, it's basically the regulatory aspect of the licensee. Additionally, the concern is that this provision was initially tied to a criminal charge, and apparently it was a charge, and there was supposed to be a finding of the agency. And the concern we had at that point was that for criminal charge, and what we're hearing about the reason to put the penalty in as a civil administrative penalty was because we couldn't meet the standards of a conviction, so we wanted to get at them in another way. And I think we have some concerns with that. If you can't meet the criminal conviction and those standards, then why should we make there be an easier standard with less due process that they could follow through and penalize these folks as well? Now that we've tied it to the civil penalty, I have a concern with that is arguably the same evidentiary standard, and if the civil penalty standard is too high, and that we want this standard to be a lower standard than that, then I think that's even a bigger problem. And so I would just say that at this point we're very concerned about the administrative penalty under Section 2 of the bill and would ask you to delete that section at this point or continue to work with this, but it seems to be going in different directions that aren't really reaching a resolution. With regard to Subdivision 3 or Section 3 of the bill, that's the deauthorization if you're convicted of insurance fraud. We support that provision as it's currently written as amended with the following two caveats. One is the fact that the insurance fraud conviction should be related to insurance fraud being committed while under the no-fault auto insurance statute rather than just general insurance fraud. And two, there should be a way that an individual should be able to become authorized again over a period of time if there's some rehabilitation that takes place. And finally, I should just say it should also be prospective, so we're not going back after people after the fact.
Dr. Kosoka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Goodnow, it's close enough. Mr. Goodnow, do you support any kind of a penalty? And if so, how would you administer it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gazelka, we were better with the penalty when it applied to insurers as well as individuals and healthcare providers. We're better with it if there's a sliding fee or a maximum amount that the penalties could be levied that are similar to the criminal statutes. Now, the one thing to keep in mind, too, is that it's $25,000 per occurrence. And so for a chiropractor who may be, just dealing with one person who is injured in an automobile accident that provides three adjustments a week for 4 weeks, that could be, 12 occurrences of insurance fraud because each one would be a submission. And so, again, there's an issue about the, quote, crime or the bad act fitting the penalty that could be there. And so if there's some way we could cap the maximum, that would be more acceptable. And application more broadly, but I do think there's just an underlying concern about extending the authority of commerce to also include individuals and healthcare providers that's currently beyond their scope.
Mr. Chair?
Sir, did you wish to?
Well, I just want to clarify that under 14045, the agency, there is factors that they have to take into consideration when. So what we say is that could be $25,000. They have to look at the willfulness, the gravity of the violation, what damage was done, the history of violations, number of violations, the economic benefit gained by the person by allowing or committing the violation, and other factors that would be required. So those things are already in the administration of these civil penalties.
Sir, did you another witness at the desk?
I'm Dr. Wayne Dahl. I'm representing doctors and auto accident injury victims doing revolutionary stand-up weight-bearing MRIs in the position of pain to show its cause. I'm a chiropractor for 38 years, 28 years with hands-on patients, and for the last 10 years I've been doing SUMA stand-up MRI. Immediately upon creating SUMA, we became embroiled in lawsuits with insurance companies, and originally in the first 10 years it started out with a few, and now we're in the hundreds. And what we're trying to do is protect the patients, because when there is attorney fraud or insurance company fraud and the bills don't get paid, they ultimately can fall upon the patients and endanger the consumer. What we feel is the ultimate fraud is when insurers use the injured patient's premium dollars to defraud patients and when attorneys ignore their fiduciary responsibilities by not paying doctors, both of which pit the doctors against their patients to try and get paid and just try to stay in business to treat the next auto accident injury victim. 72A.201 was mentioned. There's a handout that I've got here that I think all of you should look at and read. One of them is a letter from Rick Stemple, who's a prominent fraud lawyer. As a matter of fact, he was referenced in the previous meeting about a car crash ring. That letter talks to an insurance company that refuses to explain why it is that they won't pay 70 claims. In other words, they just say, oh, there's too many claims for us to address. You'll see the American Family part of this handout, which addresses 207 claims. The 207 claims, of which 184 of them, the insurer refused to pay at all or give an explanation why they didn't pay them. In the 23 remaining claims of the 207, in other words, 90% of the claims they didn't pay at all and refused an explanation. In the 10% or the 23 other claims, the attorneys got the money and never even informed Summa that they had it or made any attempt to pay. So this is the kind of fraud that's out there with respect to insurance companies. We'll be filing a suit next week on another 70 claims, and we're investigating another insurer on 160-some claims. So there's the bill that you have here. Providers are always in favor of getting rid of insurance fraud. And as a matter of fact, I thank you all for your help with the runners and cappers steers anti-fraudulent advertising bill, which did run one of the Floridian groups back to Florida. That was instituted by providers. And you remember last year there were 46 providers who were named in the Minneapolis Star for receiving kickbacks from a MRI center that was led by an unlicensed individual. And that was also started with providers exposing other providers. So providers are absolutely in favor of getting rid of fraud. And this bill, if it's worded right, we certainly would be in favor of that. To give you a little bit of a historical perspective, in 1974, we had $20,000 in benefits for no-fault treatment of injured patients. With inflation today, that would be $160-some thousand dollars. Or inversely, in 2004, the $20,000 we have now equates to $2,500. Well, believe me, in 1976, when I started my practice, the insurance companies didn't have any problem at all paying out $2,500. Now, they have great problems paying out anything and refuse to explain why it is that they're not paying any benefits at all. So we view this bill as has to take into account fraud by insurers as well as fraud by attorneys, because if you don't get rid of all of the fraud, you're still going to have a fraudulent system. So I think that's very important. We had a demonstration at Summa MRI where we had an educational lecture where we had 200 doctors present, and a prominent member of a Commerce Committee was at that particular meeting when we discussed this American Family case of the 207. The question was asked to the audience, who here by a show of hands, raise your hand if you've billed American Family Insurance. 200 doctors, 100% of them had billed American Family Insurance. The next question was, who here received payment from American Family Insurance? There wasn't a single hand raised. So believe me, there's insurance fraud on behalf of the, and it's all documented in that handout, both the Stemple letter on Farmers Insurance, not giving an explanation. The 207 cases against American Family are documented. And basically what the modus operandi of the insurance carriers is that you call the insurance company, you say, what's going on with this case? And the next thing they say is, we can't tell you. Talk to the attorney. You call the attorney, and what does he say? either he doesn't answer the phone or he won't talk to you at all or admit that he received any money. So then we have further cases now that we're seeing rising where attorneys are getting checks with Suma's name on them, and they're running the checks through the bank, okay, without endorsements. And we've got several other attorneys.
All right, I think we've got that. Your points are well made. We've got to actually go over time, a half an hour, because the next committee is coming in about 2 minutes. So, I don't know. We're going to take this up very first thing Monday. We do have a full agenda, but I do want to process these bills, and if there's any way a few things could be tweaked, that's fine, and sometimes there's not any tweaking, and I understand that. So we're going to give you a little time till Monday. We're not going to take a lot of time Monday. It's going to be probably 10, 15 minutes.
Mr. Chair, I think I have to withdraw my amendment motion before we lay it on the table?
Yeah,
that probably be,
I don't think you have to.
Okay, I just want to make sure.
So that's the, I think we're only about 1-for-4 today, but again, we like to do. That's not good. If you're a baseball player, you're going to get fired today. But don't fire me yet. Well, we're going to adjourn today, and then if there's some tweaking that a cup of champion or Lats or Goodwin or somebody can do a little bit, fine. If not, we'll go up or down Monday because we can't ignore
them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, that's where we're at. Full agenda Monday. Let's try to get here on time. And with that, Commerce Committee's adjourned for the day.